This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thank you for downloading The Global Philosopher, in which Harvard's Michael Sandel leads a global debate in a state-of-the-art digital studio.
My name is Michael Sandel. Welcome to this first episode of The Global Philosopher. For our listeners on BBC Radio 4, I should explain. I'm standing in a rather amazing new studio in Boston, looking at a wall with 60 video screens. It's a facility called HBX Live, designed by the Harvard Business School to enable teaching and learning on a global scale. Participants from over 30 countries are beamed up on these screens and will join in our discussion. In addition to the people visible here in the studio, hundreds more are watching online and will send comments by text as the discussion proceeds. Today we take up one of the most fraught moral and political questions of our time, the question of immigration. Few issues generate more heated debate, but we rarely discuss the big philosophical questions underlying this debate. Should national borders matter? And if so, why? To discuss this question, we've gathered a group of people from around the world, not philosophers, but thoughtful citizens from a great many places, from Athens and Amman, Bangalore and Budapest, Calgary and Cape Town, Moscow and Milan, and we're engaged together in an experiment. Thanks to the wonders of technology, we've convened a global conversation to be heard on radio and viewed online. If you detect an audio glitch or two from time to time, I hope you will forgive us as we seek to work out this new platform for global public discourse. The first question I would like to put to our global group of discussants is about the distinction, if any, between how countries should treat refugees and how countries should treat immigrants. Now, refugees traditionally are defined as people who are fleeing war or persecution, whereas immigrants may be seeking admission to a country for any number of reasons, perhaps for greater economic opportunity. And the question I'd like to put to you to begin our discussion is this. Do countries have different moral duties with respect to refugees and immigrants? Let's begin with the following poll question about refugees. Does a country have a right to deny entry to a refugee who arrives at its border fleeing war or persecution? Answer yes or no. We'll see what people think. Are we ready? 86% say no. A country does not have the right to refuse admission to a refugee, whereas 14% say yes. Now, I'd like to put another question to you, this one about the duty to accept immigrants. The question is this: does a country have a right to deny entry to an immigrant who arrives at its border fleeing dire poverty or economic hardship? Yes or no? Are we ready? This is a much closer vote. 58% say yes, a country does have a right to deny entry. 42% say no. So clearly, people have different views about the moral duty a country has to admit refugees by comparison with its duty to admit immigrants. So let me put this question. Of those here who think there is a duty to admit refugees, but not necessarily to admit immigrants, what would be your reason? Why the difference? Who will begin our discussion? Tara, in the U.S.
I think the difference for myself is that in any country, we have people living in poverty. And you cannot control for that all the time. You can't save everyone. But when someone's coming in need of actual safety, it's a matter of life or death, then I think that that's a little different for myself.
Thank you for that. In Amman, Abdul, what do you think?
I just want to ask why, as long as he doesn't put any country in a risk or something, as long as he'll bring economical benefits to the country, then why you should deny him? I'm talking about immigrants.
All right. Tara, would you like to reply to Abdul in Amman?
Yes, and I don't think that we should deny immigration altogether. I think that we do need to control in any country how many people are coming back and forth. It's a matter of resources. So I'm not against immigration altogether, but I do think that a country does have a right to say when that immigration might need to stop if it means putting their own citizens in jeopardy.
Thank you for that. In Amman, Abdul, I want to come back to you. You question Tara's idea that a country doesn't have a duty to admit immigrants. Do you think there is a moral difference in the duty to accept refugees as against the duty to accept, say, economic migrants?
Yes, of course, because refugees is kind of an emergency, and it's temporary. I don't think it's permanent.
In Germany, Simon, what do you say?
Okay, so I think with immigrants, I think a country does not really have the right to deny because you look at the situation in Germany right now, after the Second World War, everything has lost. And the working population are the ones that are funding the pensions of the older age group. And in Germany, the problem is that the population is not increasing. People are not giving birth to more children to increase the population. Okay. So if you don't bring in immigrants, what are you going to use to fund the aging population in the future?
Okay, thank you for that. Now, we have two very interesting comments that have been sent in by observers who are watching online, both of whom dispute the moral difference between the duty to admit a refugee and the duty to admit an economic migrant. Let's go to Dave at the BBC, who's been monitoring the comments from those who are watching online.
Yes, we've had a comment from Israel saying we have a stronger moral obligation to save a life than merely to improve somebody's material well-being. But Simon, who has sent in a comment from the south of England, from Plymouth, says, what's the difference between dying from bombs or dying from starvation?
All right, let's take that challenge from Simon in Plymouth, UK. He says, is there a difference between dying from bombs and dying from starvation? And if there isn't, Simon's suggesting that morally, the duties of states are the same, whether it's someone fleeing war and persecution or whether it's someone fleeing dire poverty and starvation. In Greece, Angeliki, what do you think about this?
Hello, Professor. It's a great honor to be here with you, with everybody. Well, immigrants, I think that a country can actually deny.
Can deny. How do you answer the challenge from Simon in Plymouth, UK, who said, what really is the difference between dying from bombs and dying from starvation? What would be your answer to that challenge?
Well, I think that opportunities that are everywhere, no matter where somebody is, I think it's up to the individual to find them. Going to a richer country doesn't always guarantee success. I mean, we have all witnessed immigrants ending up living in worse conditions than the ones they previously lived in. And besides, I think that an immigrant has the money to flee his country, his or her country, actually. So I think that it's up to the individual to decide whether or not this is a risk worth taking.
Okay,
or
so
not.
If I hear you right, Angelique, you say the difference is it's a humanitarian emergency in the case of the refugee, mm-hmm. but in the case of the economic migrant, that person might be able to realize to find greater economic opportunity in a great many countries. So there's not the same kind of emergency. In Brazil, Leo, what do you say?
I was an illegal immigrant myself. Let me reveal that. And I spent 3 months in a detention center before I was deported back to Brazil from the UK for being there illegally. And despite all that happened to me about this immigration matter, I still believe that some countries, some European countries, have the right to take unilateral actions. I was a kind of economic migrant which moves abroad looking for a better life. The real big deal migrants we're talking about are the refugees, which are fleeing from political persecution and religious intolerance and things like that. These migrants are the ones which we know among them, there will be some dangerous people.
This is very powerful testimony, Leo, because if I hear you right, what you're saying is that you yourself were an economic migrant to Britain and
yes.
that you were forced to leave. You were deported. Is that right?
That's right, but I don't blame the UK border agents. They're just doing their jobs.
So, Leo, you're saying even though you were deported, you affirm the right of Britain to have sent you away, though you say if you had been a refugee, you would not have agreed with their right to send you away. Do I have that right, Leo?
Yeah, you got that right, Professor. Yeah, and I pretty agree with what they did. I was aware about what I was doing. I knew it was wrong, and I knew I couldn't be there forever.
So you took your chance. You lost.
I took my chance.
You were sent back, and you don't blame Britain for having sent you back.
No, not at all.
This is a pretty powerful story. In Germany, Lena, what do you think of Leo's story?
First of all, obviously, I think it's great that you've got a personal opinion to share on this rather than me talking theoretically, but let me do that anyway. I don't think it's a question of resources, as Tara, you called it earlier, that aren't enough for all of us, because I think in the world, we've got space for all of us and we've got enough resources for all of us. And I think we're making it too easy for ourselves if we say this country is full or this country doesn't have any more to give. Plus, I think Germany, for example, has an awful lot more to give. So I think we just have to stop thinking about countries, stop thinking about races, stop thinking about religions and all these issues and just say there's one world, there's people living in it, and I think there's enough for all of us here.
It's a very generous sentiment you've expressed, Lena. Are you suggesting that countries don't really have the right to keep people out, that national borders ideally, from a moral point of view, should not be enforced, in fact, should be overcome?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Lena has a very strong view that there is no moral significance to national borders, that ideally we should regard one another as human beings, not as members of this or that country, and therefore you would favor completely open borders, would you, Lena?
Yeah.
All right, who disagrees with Lena and would like to reply? Okay, in India, Sudhindra, you disagree with Lena. Tell us why.
I'd like to just preface my answer with something that we have always been told as children. We've always been told that the world is a global village and that the Earth is our planet. But the truth of the matter is that the reason why some countries become popular destinations for living is because they do some things right. Today, if people choose to live in countries like Switzerland, like Germany, like US and UK, it's because they do some things much better than other countries.
Sudhindra, you say some countries just do things right. They
yes.
become more affluent and they have a right to keep people out. Is that what you're saying, Sudhindra?
Yes, and I'm also saying that that unique selling proposition of that country is no longer valid when you flood that country with a million or 10 million people. Germany will lose its proposition as the chosen geography if suddenly it found itself besieged with 20 million people.
Lena.
I'm not saying that the whole world should come and live in Germany. I'm saying that everybody should be able to live in their very own country in peace and without having to be scared that their child is going to starve to death.
But if you open the borders, that will no longer be the case. How would you stop people?
For now, maybe, but not forever. Because then the situation would go down in Germany, let's say, if everybody came here. And then people might say, you know what, there's more space in whichever country and they'll go there. It's that example we all learned in biology of the sharks and the fish. There's more sharks, there's less fish. That means there's less sharks and there's more fish, you know. It goes around in a circle.
I don't think any country is willing to take that chance.
All right, thank you for that exchange. In the UK, Simon, what do you think?
I think we're at a really serious and sacred moment in our human story, and we either see ourselves as brother or other. And I couldn't agree more with what Lena's been saying, that we're all natives of this earth. And I think that globalization, the economy, knows no borders. Climate change knows no borders as well. So the moral argument, the logical argument, just falls down. And it shows for me how obsolete the nation-centric entitlement comes in. We're in such a privileged position to be able to say yes to you, no to you. Who do we think we are? It's time that we either listen to the likes of Donald Trump or we look into the children's eyes in Calais, in Dunkirk, and we say that we are one global family together, and let's open up our hearts, open up our homes, open up our borders.
So Simon and Lena favor a universalistic ethic that regards humanity, not members of nations, as the relevant moral considerations. And Lena and Simon are arguing that we should overcome the use and the emphasis and the enforcement of national borders. I'd like now to hear from people who disagree with that idea. In Hungary, Orsolya, what do you say to what you've heard from Lena and Simon?
Well, I understand their opinion, but let's take international law point of view, that international law says if I'm a refugee, I have the right not to be killed. So I can flee from bombs, from shootings, from whatever, but I don't have the right to actually choose which country I want to live. Even international law doesn't say that a refugee can choose between countries.
Is there someone who has a moral argument to make in favor of national borders? In Israel, Basel.
Thank you. The very existence of a state was based on the presumption that if there is no controlling state, if there's no controlling authority, then everybody would kill everybody because that's just the laws of nature. And otherwise, when we think about it morally, I personally cannot live comfortably with somebody who doesn't speak my own language, who doesn't have my own culture. We do not share the humor. We do not share the same cultural background. So nullifying national borders would really mix everybody with everybody. And there would be no culture. There would be no national heritage for any country, for any person to just say that this is who I am. There would no person would be able to morally define themselves. And so, that is very, very dangerous.
So Basel speaks about language, culture, a shared history. National borders give expression to these forms of community, Basel seems to be saying, and our moral definition as persons depends on being members of communities, cultures, traditions that are defined by certain shared histories and languages. Do I have it right, Basel?
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
In Brazil, João, what would you say?
I agree with Basel. We should be together in our country because we share a lot of things, a lot of responsibilities, a lot of reasons to be together. So I think the borders is some way to organize that, to allow us to live with the people who are most like us.
To live with the people who are most like us is what national borders enable us to do, João says in Brazil. And that's a good thing.
No.
No?
No.
Who says no?
No.
In Italy, Giuseppe says no.
Say no.
What I can say, for example, in Italy, if you take Italy, people living in north of Italy are culturally more close to German people than the people living in the south of Italy. A very famous statement from a politician in Italy, when Italy has been built, he say, now we have done Italy, we have to do Italians, meaning that we came from very, very difficult cultures. So all the reasons I've seen to defend borders are only cultural, economical, logistical reason, but I don't see really a moral reason. Borders come from war. Or if you take the map of Africa, you see straight line put by someone, say, okay, this is one state, this is another one.
Okay, so Giuseppe's reply is, national borders are the result of accident, contingency, of war. So how can they have any moral significance? That's Giuseppe's challenge. In Wisconsin, Mitra.
Yes, I would like to make several comments. One is historically, if you look at humanity, our history is a history of migration. I mean, humans, as long as they have been able to move, creatures, as long as they have been able to move, they have moved across the planet. This is one planet. I mean, look at Europe. They have been working the last several decades or so trying to open borders because they understand there is no more reason for the borders. Also understand, people, if they are comfortable where they are, they are not willing to give up their families, their own cultures, their own beliefs, to move halfway across the world so that they can survive. I am an immigrant, and trust me, I understand that. It's not easy to move up, uproot yourself, uproot your entire family, and go somewhere else, learn a new language, learn a new way of life halfway across your life. Corporations are also immigrants. If corporations can easily move across borders, I cannot see why humans cannot.
Aha. If corporations can move across borders, why not? May I ask, you mentioned that you're an immigrant yourself. From what country?
I immigrated to the United States from Iran.
From Iran?
Yes.
Let's go to Dave at the BBC, who's been monitoring the comments from those who are watching online.
We've got hundreds of comments coming in. Alistair from South Africa is puzzled by the difference between inequality between countries and inequality within a country. He asks, if you allow free immigration, where do you draw the line? Living in a very unequal society like South Africa, would he, Alistair, have to allow someone from a nearby township to move into his house? And Haita, we don't know where she's from, Haita says that borders signify more than just geography. They indicate shared political thought, cultural history, and national belief.
Which connects with what Basil and some others have been suggesting here. I'd like to ask a different question. Most people would agree, I assume, that countries do not have the right to prevent their people from leaving, their citizens from exiting. Does everybody agree that a country does not have the right to prevent its citizens from exiting? Is there anyone who disagrees, who thinks that they do have a right? Anyone? Yadidja, are you raising your hand?
I think that if a country is in war and it needs soldiers, for instance, to protect other people, then you should not let people just run away and actually maintain a certain sustainable army in order to protect other citizens. It's a civil service, it's a civil duty. And in fact, in Israel, you are prevented from leaving the country from the day you are enlisted to the army, from the day of when you turn 17 and a half, 18, for about 3 years. And I do see some reasonable justification in that, you know, claim.
Okay, in the case of war, or if you're performing national service or serving in the military. All right. Now, do countries have a right to prevent their citizens from exiting? Vote yes or no, and we'll see what the distribution is. Do countries have a right to prevent their citizens from exiting? All right, let's see what the percentages are. 77% say no, 23% say yes. Now, a question I would like to put to the 77% who say no, countries do not have the right to prevent exit. And this takes us to the next poll. Do countries have a right to prevent outsiders from entering? Let's take a vote on that. Here's the point I'm trying to get to. If countries do not have the right to keep their citizens from leaving, how can it be the case that they have a right to prevent other people from entering? Now, Do countries have a right to prevent outsiders from entering? 83% said yes. So 83% said states do have the right to prevent entering, whereas 77% said states do not have the right to prevent exit. So what is the moral difference between the two? In Spain, Amar, what do you think?
I think there's a difference between a duty and a right. The very basic duty of a state is the security of its people. And for that reason, just for security, they may need to prevent people leaving and they may need to prevent people from coming in.
And what would be a scenario, Amir, where the state would be justified, do you think, in preventing someone from leaving?
Maybe who has a contagious disease that could potentially spread to another country. We saw borders shut recently. In those situations, you can see that a state is caring about the security of its own citizens and of other citizens as well. It's a very specific case. Another one would be somebody who, a jihadist or any form of terrorist that is intent on causing a security problem abroad or in your own country. And for those very, very specific situations, both right. entering and exiting has to be monitored at the very minimum, but sometimes restricted.
Okay. In Brazil, we just had a comment from someone in Brazil observing online who thinks there is a difference. The difference is that you should be free to leave a group, but everybody should not be free to join a group. Who can join, that should be up to the members, the already existing members of the group. There are others who have thoughts about this, but I want to call upon you after we look at two of the reasons people have raised in defense of borders. And we hear this in the debate about immigration. One argument in the defense of preserving and enforcing national borders is to do with standards of living, protecting jobs at home, protecting wages from erosion if immigrants come and compete for jobs. Standards of living. We often hear that public services will be strained, welfare provision will be strained if immigrants come and take advantage of those services. So that's one argument. Economic arguments of various kinds to do with standard of living, GDP. And then we've heard a different argument, which is about culture, history, shared traditions. I would like to see what this group thinks about these two different arguments in favor of national borders, two arguments in favor of restricting immigration in some circumstances. Who thinks that national identity, preserving national identity, is a legitimate reason to restrict immigration? In Romania, Erno, tell us why.
Yes, I think that preserving national identity is something which has been done by our predecessors for long centuries, and this is something which identifies us.
Thank you for that. And in Kenya, Deborah.
With regard to the issue of preserving the national identity, you have to take into consideration that some countries do not have any national identity to preserve. So for me, the issue of restricting immigration based on that does not hold water. And I'm speaking from a perspective of African countries which are cobbled up together without any regard for nationality. I mean, nationhood rather. So in this regard, this national identity does not arise. And speaking as a Kenyan, I don't see that the fact that we have Somalis in the country, Sudanese in the country, the fact that we have them has not affected our Kenyanness or lack thereof. So in my opinion, this is not a reason for a country to restrict immigration.
And that's in part because you view national borders as artificial to begin with?
Absolutely, yeah. They are totally unnecessary.
In Athens, Christine, what do you think?
I think that the national identity is very, very important for countries that have common nation, because common nation is a constituted community of people, historical constituted community people, with common traditions, common customs, common ethnicity. So by allowing everybody to enter our borders, yes, I do believe that this will destroy the special national characteristics.
So Christine has cited national identity, shared culture, shared ethnicity as what makes countries distinctive, what holds them together. And that's a reason to defend borders and to enforce borders. Now, Simon, earlier on, Simon in the UK, you argued against the moral significance of national borders. Let's see if we can put Simon and Christine together on the screen. Speak directly to Christine in Athens and see if you can persuade her.
Well, I'd say, Christine, that in Britain here, we're often cited by politicians about British values. But any kind of national identity, if it doesn't contain compassion for all and openness to all, the identity, the brand, has no credibility whatsoever. The very idea of a national identity is oxymoronic. It needs to include all. Otherwise, it's simply not credible in the globalized world in which we live.
You think there is no such thing as a national identity?
The only credible national identity is one that opens its arms to others, that doesn't see itself as privileged or entitled in any way, or sees others as less worthy of being on this earth than the rest of us.
In Bulgaria, Vladimir, what do you say?
We really have a serious problem because we don't seem to have any politicians in our audience here. We don't have any rich people. We have only intelligent middle-class people who are open-minded, with very few exceptions. And it's absurd in a world where we live with very stupid politicians, with people who try to change national identity through force and create enormous problems and create actual migration. We here are all very happy and discuss idealistic views, which are all very good. The problem is that practically they don't work because we have politicians who are completely different. We have very rich people who have completely different ideas about everything. And we have countries. You can't discuss what could you do when you do have countries.
Go ahead, Simon.
This is not idealism. Donald Trump right now is saying that to make America great again, we should build a wall. We should build a wall. This is not idealism. This is a choice that we have.
Okay. Simon has spoken of idealism and a universal aspiration. I wonder if I could hear from someone here who defends the idea of restricting immigration for the sake of national identity, who can articulate what he or she takes to be the idealism of that position. In Greece, Angeliki.
I would like to underline this, which I think escapes us all. Without being specific, there are certain religions which are disguised political movements. Okay, they provide no education to their people. They oppress especially females in their countries. They brainwash their citizens. Okay, and all these people, okay, they want to invade and corrupt civilized countries with their own identity.
So you do think that preserving national identity is...
It's of utter importance.
All right. We've had a lot of comments coming in from those who are watching online. Let's turn to Dave at the BBC. What are they saying?
We had a comment from Ying in The Hague, who says that preserving national identity is the reason racists give for restricting immigration. There have been many comments about the pace of change. Beth from India says there's a huge difference between a gradual change to identity over 50 years and an enormous change which takes place in a short period with a big burst of immigration. And Alija says that we should remember that melting a national identity with new arrivals can actually enrich an identity.
Thank you for that. Yedidya, in Israel, Yedidya, what do you say?
You know, national identity, I think Simon was presenting this this one criteria for being a legitimate, you know, national identity. I think that some people strive to have a sense of connection to people that are like them, of connection, of culture, of heritage, of family. So to come and say that it's only legitimate to have a national identity which is all-inclusive and encompasses all citizens of the world, I think it's ignoring the very fundamental fact as a human being that we do connect to things that are similar to us, on an emotional level at least. This is not a purely logical argument. So you have to not disregard the emotional connection people have to things that are similar to them.
You disagree with Simon and with,
of course,
Lena,
I wouldn't say we should transcend these differences. Yeah, I wouldn't say I completely disagree. I would say that you cannot disregard the fact that people strive to feel connected to something. It's not only a universal world. That's part of it. But it's also a sense that people want to feel connected. And you can't completely disregard that. Like, why is that any different than just wanting to be part of everything?
Lena, in Germany, Lena, what do you say?
Why does it have to be nation? Why can't it be the fact that we all have stripy T-shirts or that we like to eat cheese? You know what I mean?
Or you're being cynical towards it. It's not stripy T-shirts. A person has a culture and heritage. It's not something that's
exactly.
just a T-shirt. You're responding in a very cynical manner. Some people
have connections.
We have attachments to things that are like us, not for no sensible reason.
Go ahead, Lena.
So first of all, I've got four grandparents from four countries. So which of these countries am I supposed to identify myself with? I don't know.
That's a personal question. That's what I mean by stripy T-shirts.
For me, it's not about a country. It's about the fact that I feel strongly about, let's say, feminism. So yeah, I'm connected with feminists across the world. I feel strongly about children. So I like people who like children. It doesn't have to be people who also happen to have a German passport. Another point that I think is very important is we mustn't forget that nationalism and religion and culture and all these things have been used time and again as a reason to discriminate people, to kill people. Germany, not so long ago, said, you know what, you group of religious people, no longer part of our country. You're not citizens anymore, mm-hmm. as a reason to think we were then allowed to do whatever with them. So I just think there's a massive risk to creating these kind of us and them ideas. And I don't care if it's stripy T-shirts or religion or a race or whatever.
I just think that essentially we don't really disagree. I think that it's a legitimate idea to want to be a citizen of the world. But it's also a legitimate idea to want to be a citizen of my city, of my hometown. And to find that balance between nationalism on a global scale and nationalism on an urban scale, for instance, is not a disagreement. But you have to be able to accept both ideas.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Let me see. I know there are others with things to contribute. But let me see if I can draw together some of the strands of the discussion that we've heard here today. And to see how it all connects to the debates that are raging in countries around the world about the question of immigration. On the surface, the debates about immigration seem to be about economics, about the effect of immigration on jobs, on wages, on welfare benefits, on standards of living. But it seems to me that the reason the immigration debate generates such heat and passion and anger and anxiety is that this debate touches on deeper, bigger questions than economics alone. Questions like, what do we owe one another as citizens? Do we owe more to our fellow citizens than we owe to humanity as such? Should I, as an American, care more about the welfare of someone, let's say, in Texas, whom I've never met, than I should care about someone living in Mexico, just across the border, or not? And then there's the question of patriotism, which underlies much of this debate. Is patriotism a virtue, or is it a kind of prejudice? A prejudice for our own kind, ideally, to be overcome. Back in the 18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote powerfully in defense of patriotism and particularity. And this was the argument he offered. He said, It seems that the sentiment of humanity evaporates and weakens in being extended over the entire world, and that we cannot be affected by the calamities in Tartary or in Japan the way we are by those of a European people. This is Rousseau. Interest and commiseration, he wrote, must somehow be limited and restrained to be active. Do we want people to be virtuous, Rousseau wrote, then let us begin by making them love their country. But how can they love it if their country means nothing more to them than it does to foreigners, allotting to them only what it cannot refuse to anyone? Now, we've heard from those who think national borders give expression to shared national identities, and we've heard from those who believe national borders are morally arbitrary, obstacles to the realization of our humanity, ideally to be overcome. These are long-standing debates, but I can't help but wonder whether discussing them now, here, in this way, globally, might cast these long-standing questions of political philosophy in a new light. Rousseau thought that we can't be affected by calamities half a world away. But what happens when we can witness those calamities almost from the moment they happen? What happens when we can discuss and debate the appropriate response to those calamities with people from around the world in a conversation like this? When we can do that, could it be that the line between members and strangers will begin to blur? Well, it's hard to know. This technology and the discussions it makes possible are really just at their infancy. But I think it is fair to say that this discussion offers us a glimpse of what reasoned global public discourse might be. And so to our participants from around the world, to those listening on radio, to those watching online, I want to thank you for joining us for this, the first episode of The Global Philosopher. Thank you very much.
The Global Philosopher was presented by Michael Sandel and produced by David Edmonds. The studio producer is Louise Coletta and the editor is Richard Knight. You can also watch the Global Philosopher video on the Radio 4 website.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.